to that third step, but I'm glad that you've all taken your seats. We've got one last presentation here, Translating Electronic Literature, a transatlantic program in collaborative digital humanities, and it's a very large team. Arnaud Regnault from Paris 8, John Cayley from Brown University, Søren Pott from Aarhus, Manuel Portela from Coimbra, and Maria Mencia from Kingston College, and Gabriel Tremblay-Godet from Paris 8, and did I get everybody? Yeah. Okay, and here you go. I'm going to set the timer for 47 minutes, and then we'll have 10 minutes for discussion. So there'll be a little chime at 47 minutes.
Well, thank you. First, on behalf of the team, I'd like to thank the Mellon Foundation and the FMSH for having us today and for making this all possible. So I'll deal with the general introduction to this presentation. So over the last 2 years, members of our research initiative have been focusing on issues pertaining to the translation of works of electronic literature. Due to the technical and technological specificity of this new field of literature, the process of translation is complexified and needs to be addressed more broadly by combining different methodologies and skills. To highlight and examine specific aspects of the translation process, we've been considering four distinct perspectives. Translinguistic, that means translation between languages, transcoding, translation between machine-readable code and human-readable text, transmedial, translation between medial modalities, and transcreation, translation as a shared creative practice. Obviously, these four perspectives are not mutually exclusive, and more often than not, they overlap during the translation process. So this research project that was financed thanks to the Mellon Foundation and the FMSH allowed us to hire a coordinator, a programmer, and a translator who collaborated with the five partners of the project to produce the translation of five works. So we dealt with John Cayley's The Listeners, Manuel Portela, and Luis Lucas Pereira's Machines of Disquiet, Maria Mencia's The Poem That Crossed the Atlantic, Soren Pold and Christian Ulrich Anderson's The Poetry Machine, and finally Michael Joyce's Afternoon, A Story. In addition to several publications and papers by each member, the research team as a group offered roundtable presentations and workshops, several high-profile international events, including the conference Beyond Words, Multimodal Encounters in Translation in Cambridge earlier this summer, as well as the Electronic Literature Organization International Conferences in Porto in 2017 and in Montreal in 2018, where all five works were presented during the Mind the Gap exhibition. A summary of our endeavor will be published in a special issue of the international hypermedia journal Bleu Orange later this fall, with our white paper as an introductory text. Several methodological and conceptual insights have resulted as the outcome of the project. Working with Gabriel Tremblay-Godet on the production of the translation of Afternoon, we discovered how to go beyond the cybernetic loop, and I'll come back to that in a minute, and offer a visualization of the network mapping of this seminal work of hyperfiction in order to facilitate future translations in other languages. John Cayley's concepts of, quote, translation as process, unquote, has permeated every member's production of their translation. Søren Pold contribution focuses on translation as a literary experience, whereas Maria Mencia introduces us to the benefits of the research transcreational approach. And finally, Manuel Portela, along with Mencia and Pold, suggested in the conclusion of a landmark essay published in the Journal of Electronic Book Review, the discovery and highlighting of electronic tropes through the translation process. That's for the general framework. Now, I'd like to come back very quickly on the more theoretical aspect, just to highlight what we mean by going beyond the cybernetic loop. And this may resonate with previous discussions we've had so far here. So should we follow the cybernetic hypothesis, the multi-layered text to be translated, the one you have on screen, emerges as a regulatory system in which human and non-human agents are connected in networks of control and communication. The task of the translating agent is to receive, process, and return information while metaphorically pursuing homeostasis, which could be understood as the production of an equivalent and stable hybrid form of code in natural language within the target languages, including both computer executable and human readable instances. In fact, translation as a form of mediation is at the core of the cybernetics hypothesis, since, quoting Alexander Galloway, the cybernetic hypothesis begins from the elemental assumption that everything is a system of mediation, unquote. Now, as Galloway further points out, quote, information is by definition highly encoded so that it may propagate and interface with agents in predictable ways. Now, this view is based on the notion that communication between different systems, a form of translation then, amounts to a problem in cryptography, bringing us back to the metaphysical belief in the existence of a transcendent code as the foundational ground from which any language will emerge. A code whose key we simply need to crack to ensure communication between two different linguistic systems. I, for one, contend that such a view bears two untenable consequences for translation. First, the necessary bracketing of meaning found in Claude Shannon's theory of communication and taken up by Warren Weaver's cybernetic view of translation. Second, the encapsulation and obfuscation of natural languages from the machinic agent's standpoint within encoded objects processed by the machine, which entails a minimization of human agency. Translation is an open-ended iterative process indeed. The translator apprehends the text to be seen, that's the one on screen, as a complex temporal object whose modulation is controlled by obfuscated computational processes affecting its eventual manifestation in the realm of the visible and even in that of the haptic, let alone other modes of semiosis. So that's what we're trying to show in our own analysis. Enough for the theoretical aspects. I'll let my colleagues take over. Just a few final words for this introduction. So we believe that the results of our research program will extend beyond its duration. Not only will the white paper to be published later this year allow a dissemination of our research results following our roundtable at ELO in Montreal this summer, colleagues from other institutions offered to share, archive, and expand on some of our achievements. What's more, in 2019, we're planning on organizing the second international symposium on the translation of electronic literature. The first one happened back in 2012 at Paris 8. So, last comment. So our research project will probably have generated important contributions not only to the emergent field of electronic literature, but also to related domains such as software studies, translation studies, and digital archiving. And now I'll let Gabriel take over.
Thank you, Arnaud. So I'll briefly talk about some aspects of the technical production of Michael Joyce's Afternoon, a story, the landmark hyperfiction work first released in 1986 on StorySpace, a software published by Eastgate System, co-written by Joyce and J. David Bolter. This pioneering work of electronic literature, republished several times since its release more than 30 years ago, is often quoted, but it turns out has been less often read and even less often read in full. Its complex network of lexias, fragments of text, some of which are protected by guard links, by which I mean that some lexias cannot be accessed unless some previous prior lexias have been read previously, as well as the proprietary nature of the software necessary to read Afternoon, turned this important contribution to our field into a famous yet elusive work. Arnaud Regnault and a team of his colleagues decided to work on a French textual translation of the work. So the original text of Afternoon was provided by Joyce upon the translation team's request as a JavaScript file. However, the most daunting task was still to come. We needed to find an open source software that will allow us to reproduce the network of lexias from the original work, including the guard links, as well as some of the interactive features and graphic interface of the previous versions. Teaming up with Alban Levaux-Vallier, who was hired through the grant offered by the FMSH and the Mellon Foundation, we settled on Twine, one of the most popular tools for creating interactive fiction over the last years. Twine is both user-friendly and very flexible, and includes most of the features that would be required for our project, thanks to an active community of collaborators who contributed add-ons and features to its source code. Now, one of the biggest issues we could have faced was that Michael Joyce never produced a complete visualization of his work, comprised of, I asked him, 538 lexias and 948 links. Reproducing this networked structure by following the links one by one in the original version of Afternoon would have been a painstakingly long process. Fortunately, someone else did it before us. In 2014, Joël Gauthier from the Laboratoire MT2 in Montreal produced such a visualization, albeit in the form of a spreadsheet, as you can see, and this picture does not include the whole mapping of Afternoon. So the original file was lost to a hasty formatting of the hard drive of the computer it was produced on, but at least we had an image file we could work with. We could follow this rudimentary map to reproduce the network structure in Twine, so this once again is not the full mapping of the work, before copy-pasting the translated text and adding the links one by one. Now, to be honest, the final version of our translation is not quite yet ready. We still have to add some of the guard fields, tinker some more with the interface, and proofread the whole thing. However, within a matter of weeks, French readers will be able to read a new version of Afternoon, one that is as close as possible to the original as we could manage to produce using softwares that, even if they are only separated by a little more than 30 years, are as different from one another as would be an illuminated manuscript and a book produced by a Rotary Press. Now, even though in my email exchanges with him, Michael Joyce expressed an open disdain towards Twine, and I've been told that Mark Bernstein, founder of Eastgate Systems, and to this day still a co-owner of the rights to Afternoon, would probably object to it to the point of pursuing legal actions against us, we could reintegrate the English text in the Twine framework and offer our updated version of this work to readers in English. In addition, the network structure we created in Twine, combined with the set of JavaScript files relabeled according to the lexias names, which I could manage to do by accessing the source code, means that any translating team interested in producing their own version of Afternoon in a new language could do so without having to consult the original version of the work in StorySpace. Now, some might consider this sacrilegious, but we feel that since a process of translation always already involves elements of a process of edition, in this specific case of electronic literature, it more often than not entails an important process of updating. In the case of Afternoon, this update was especially necessary, since fewer and fewer people have had access to the original work. Thus, our translation is also an act of preservation, albeit not stricto sensu an act of archiving, since we are producing a new version. Furthermore, as Joyce never actually produced his own graphic mapping of the narrative maze of his hyperfiction, in our process of translation, by repurposing the work carried initially by Joël Gauthier, we produced a dynamic visualization in Twine that scholars will be able to see for the first time and explore at their leisure. Now, if I had more time, I would go inside the file and play around with it, but I'm gonna. Is it Mina?
Okay. So I came late to the collaboration. Because initially I was just the author of one of the pieces that was going to be addressed for translation. The listeners is a work, I call it a work of orature, made for the Amazon Echo and the Alexa voice service. And And then when I became more integrated with the collaborative project, some of the writing that I've done on translation, I have training in Chinese language and civilization. I've translated from Chinese. I've done works on the question of translation. And I'm not going to go over these things in detail. They're there in case these slides get out into the world and you want the references. And then I started writing about how theoretically pieces of digital literature would be translated. The most recent effort to do that was actually not about digital literature, but about liminal cases of works like Georges Perec's Avoid in English. I'm blanking on the La Disparition, where process is very important, or you know, a constraint is very important to the work. Then this is a reiteration of something you've already seen, so I don't have to go over that. And then when I did my analysis, this is what I came up with. Conditions and contexts of non-correspondence. That is, and when I say non-correspondence, I mean between the linguistic artifacts. So in other words, when the process demands that there should be a justifiable non-correspondence between the linguistic objects in two natural languages, for example. In other words, we know that they're not normal translations, but we accept that they're good translations for some reason or other. And I found that that the places where the sort of tropes or topoi around which these non-correspondences occurred could be broken down into headings. So the first two are integrity and association. Integrity, these are taken from the ideas in the moral rights associated with copyright. So integrity is the integrity of the work, which can be impugned by infringements. And if you think about it, the integrity of the work of a translation is a sort of, has the work finished? So it's done in one language, but then it gets translated. So is it the same work? Is it an extension of the work? Is the whole thing the work? So the question of integrity is put into play by translation, which is, after all, a process that is applied to a text. And then association, which is or attribution, and if you another way this links into contemporary thinking is if you think about Creative Commons, the Creative Commons licenses are basically organized in relation to these two categories, or topoi, whatever you want to call them. And then, in other words, so there would be a whole class of literary works where the question of identity and association was being specifically addressed. And in digital literature, this happens a lot. You know, intertextuality becomes an important aspect of the work, or appropriation becomes an important aspect of the work. The recombination of appropriated material, all of which are sort of new challenges to the idea of literature that digital literature seems to take as some sort of value or potentially a value. And this, and of course, if the integrity is addressed, then association also. Then we have conceptualism, where you know, again, we think of the Ulipo, and we think of an address to certain types of work where the concept is very important. And you're not necessarily reading entirely for the language, you're reading for the concept. So as you read Avoid, you're looking for the absence of the ease, and you're wondering how this is going to be handled. And conceptualism, of course, predates explicit process, where you actually set out in pseudocode or actual algorithm an explicit process which the work, as it were, has to achieve for it to be the work that it's intended to be. So those are the main headings around which the question of dissonance or non-correspondence are going to appear, and then you categorize the nature of the dissonances. And I decided to, I found that I was doing this in three different, well, one overall way at the end, and two different ways. Local dissonance, by local dissonance, I mean things, I mean non-correspondences which are a function of the language locally, typically grammar, right? So you know, you have things like gender or plurality in languages, which are differentially expressed according to the rules of the grammar. And so those have, when you translate, you have to engage with those things. And the procedurally induced global dissonance is a little bit different. This is to do with the resources of the language globally available, which we might have in the past thought of as in terms of what are the expressive possibilities of French as opposed to the expressive possibilities of German. But these days it's also what are the reference resources available on the internet, let's just say on the internet. So where you have differential access to databases of material or reference materials on the when you look at English as compared to French, for example. And then you just look at what I say, procedurally induced natural linguistic non-correspondence or diversion. That's just, you just watch it happening. So let's watch it happening. So now this is the listeners. This is just an example of what had to be done in order to translate the listeners. It's going to be translated into German, a language I don't know, or I know a little bit or a tiny bit. Not only do you have to translate the text, you have to translate the paratext. So you have to, because it's going to be this artifact is going to be placed in the context of the store, the German store, the English store. Sorry, that's the Amazon store for skills for your talking, your aesthetically motivated chatbot. And you have to give it a new name, and you have to translate its description. Then, of course, there's the structure in which you are placing this, and it's a conversational robot, and you have to analyze what people say to it in terms of an intent to get it to respond in some way. That this is Amazon's vocabulary, and you have to provide on your right the sample utterances that would indicate a particular intent. So you see the list of intents, and all of those, you don't have to translate the intents, but you do have to translate the sample utterances. And you notice that there are, well, actually the number correspond, but they might not correspond. You might not be able to come with the same number of German possible, and then German possible utterances. Then we have the lists of the things that might be spoken of. And they also have to be translated into their German equivalents. I forgot to get the German slide for this one. And then another thing that suddenly occurred to me is here. This is an example of the sort of feedback you can get. The utterance is yes or continue. These are things that were actually captured by Amazon's system, and then mapped to one of my intents with a confidence value attached to it. And you think, okay, so maybe. I'm going to develop the work further. I will look at this and I will try and make a better correspondence. I will try and increase competence, and I will change my code to do so. But what about the German? That would be another effort of translation that would have to be made. And what about the integrity of the work? Was it finished? But I'm going to keep developing it in this way. And should my translator keep up and continue to provide me with translations for my modifications? So finally, we'll get to a very specific example. So here, this is not an original, a translation. These are variations. So it's a very stupid AI. But I make it so that it has slight variations. Instead of we are always listening. In the first example, you've got we are listening. So you have minor variations, which is just done with little coin flips in the code, but it makes the thing appear a little bit more human. So what do you do? Here inside the code, what you have is a switching case where literally you can see at the top, I've got, this is, can you do see the, yeah, you do. Okay, so this is the German. And then we're going to switch. Here's the English, Great British English, and American English at the end. Also, Australian English is going to default to American for the moment until I learn Australian. Oh no, I've taken it out of. Sorry. But look at the German. So you can see that that there are these little the S and the it's where there are replacements being made within the text that I coded in my original and then have to be coded for the German. How do I get back to into the full view? Sorry, am I taking too much time? I'm just about finished. How can I get back to?
Is this full screen?
Sorry. Okay, great, yeah. So you got that, and this is what this is my final slide. This is what the German translator was given, or no, Ulrika Strozek did the German translation, and she extracted from my code this sort of pseudocode on this side, and then she produced she used different methods. At times she used a bracketing system, and at times she just provided plausible, what she thought were plausible final sentences for the German for each of the variations. And then I have to put that back into the code because she's not a coder, and without German, imagine the complexities that are involved are all to get sort of minor variation, because minor variation is the only way that I can accept an idea that this piece is being should be translated. So the process in this case is just produce minor variation whenever you produce an instance of language. If you're going to translate that into another language, produce another set of similar plausible minor variations. And we already have a model of translation that has been significantly complicated in a way that needs much more work in theorizing.
Yeah, we're going to move on a bit from the sort of translinguistic translation to some of the other modes that Arnaud pointed at in the beginning. So I'm going to speak on this machine called the poetry machine, which is a machine I've worked with as part of the project, and it's not my machine in the sense that it's also a development with libraries in Denmark, in Roskilde, in order to present electronic literature in the library space, and as such it's been exhibited at many libraries across Denmark, together with other works of electronic literature since 2012, and also currently now in Norway and in Romania. And it's been, as also mentioned, shown at a good number of conferences. So as part of this, of our project here, it's been, it's also gradually moved from being a work with a specific text to being a platform with several texts. There's a bunch of our authors that's created different versions or different texts for this poetry machine, and I'm not going to mention all of them. And it's also been so in different languages, and it's also been translated. So there is sort of this translinguistic part of it as well. And we've also, as part of the project, created a new text in French, Quebec French, specifically for the exhibition of it in Montreal. So what I'm interested in here is also, you know, how do you write for such a machine? So even though we've kept a common sort of basic format and interface of the machine, including its the interaction, I can show some more pictures of it. You sort of interact with these closed books that you can't open, so you can't read them. But then you get text on the screen. There are the books, and at the end you produce a poem that's printed. And we sort of kept this But every specific text has also developed its own customized interface from author-driven poetic and aesthetic choices, so that different colors, different lengths of poems, divisions and distributions of lines and verses across the different texts. So when it was first developed, the poet of the first text was involved in the development of the machine and interface, but the later poets have to a large degree written works for the existing machine, suggesting some changes, but basically they've also written for the existing machine as a platform. So the new Danish poets, for example, chose a Pantoum format and an Indonesian format, and the Quebec text plays with homophony in variations. So there are different poetic choices in that sense. So consequently, the creation of every work happens as a negotiation between the interface of the machine and the poetic choices of the poet within the format given by this interface, including variations of the interface. So often this creative process is simultaneously inspiring and frustrating, as I guess it is writing poetry in general. The Norwegian poet, he felt that he to write for the machine and create material that users could then make poems out of, he needed himself to turn to found material or found language and make a poetic play with decontextualizing and recontextualizing found sentences from public space, whereas other poets felt different poetic needs and urges. So furthermore, all of the texts and all of the texts are stored in the machine and become material for users to play with and make their own poems. So it also raises questions of literary quality, where it is and where literary quality is created, and whether it might be located in the stored text, the interaction, the interface, algorithm, or the text that users get as an end result of their interaction. This is in a way what we also call electronic tropes, and as such, electronic tropes are both created by the machine, in the design of the machine, but also read and interpreted by the user as reflective readings of its interface and text generation possibilities. What happened here? Okay, many users come up with different answers when we ask them about literary quality and authorship in relation to the poetry machine, and most of them reflect actually rather sophisticatedly on these questions. So they don't just they don't use the machine in a naive way. So my point is that the poetry machine demonstrates what we've argued in our article as the translinguistic, the transmedial, the transcreational, and the transcoding levels, in the sense that there are translational processes on all these levels, of course in the basic language, the translinguistic, but also at interface and material levels, as ways of interpreting and translating soft and hardware interfaces from both poets and users. So translation becomes a general interpretational process throughout both designing, writing, using, and reading. A translation of electronic tropes. So furthermore, in this work, it happens as a collaborative and social process, because there are three books, so more readers at the same time. So concludingly, we believe such experiences of electronic literature translation are useful, of course, you know, are useful contributions from electronic literature to a more general understanding of software and interfaces. Interfaces not only of electronic literature, but also in general, they translate us through profiling, for instance, and we translate them when we interact with what the interfaces produce through this profiling. And we need more focus on an understanding of this translation and what it means in an age of social media and cultural industrial platforms such as Amazon and Spotify. So current contemporary translation is much more than the translinguistic translation of languages, and electronic literature can be seen as such a lab for understanding software translation, how we translate software in our work and culture, and how software itself translates work and culture, including how our action and interaction is translated in profiling and so on. including a critical humanistic understanding of these new meta-dimensions of interfaces. This is, so could we dream of a more literary understanding of data and how it is used by, for instance, Google, Facebook and Amazon, or dream of a more literary web? Maybe these, or we believe these kind of concerns should be key concerns for digital humanities.
Thank you.
Yeah, I got some more slides. Well, actually, switching on to Maria.
Yeah. Okay. So now I go here, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to introduce you to the Winnipeg, the poem that crossed the Atlantic. This is a piece of work that is being like a case study as well to study translation and the process of translation as a creative practice. I am an artist as well as an academic, and I do practice-based research. So this translation process has been all fitting in within that area. So here we have this project, which is a story of migration and translation using remediation and remix practice-based methodologies in the production of multimodal poetic narrative spaces. And this is, you know, the kind of work that I always do, as well as many other people in electronic literature, with the idea of, you know, multimodality, poetics, the digital, narrative spaces that mix in between narratives and poetics. And this consists of a website. The website has an archive, and it has also an interactive poem. This interactive poem, which is a transatlantic poem, is a hybrid digital poetic work with a cross-fertilization of languages in Spanish, in English, and French. And I have to say that I come to this project as the creator, as translator. So it's kind of looking at the process and how perhaps I interpret or translate or produce things in the design and process in between the semantic and the visual. And so this is where I've been looking. So it's translation as creative practice-based research methodologies, and using the dimensions that we have set up as guidelines to understand the process and media connections, okay? So I have been looking at the transmedial, the transcoding, translinguistic, and how all those dimensions actually fit in. You know, I reflect through those dimensions in the production of the work, as I've been producing the work. So just to cite Bruce Archer, says there are circumstances where the best or only way to shed light on a process is to attempt to construct something or to enact something calculated to explore, embody, or test it. And that is the actual process of exploring those dimensions through the production, through the making, which practice-based, again, is a very kind of interdisciplinary approach. It's an approach used in, well, different research processes, but definitely in the arts. And I'm using this remediation of forms and remix and multimodal studies. And there is also a whole kind of layers of these courses that come up in a creative project like this one, which can be like autobiographical or to do with history, or, you know, personal stories, also to do with software and coding, and, you know, so there is all these kind of different layers. You know, the historical memory is something that has really come out very strongly through producing this work. And, so I'm kind of addressing the author as translator, where the roles of the author and the translator... Oh, hello. Have gone kind of, it's okay, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, they are kind of entangled in a way. So, okay, so here we go. The Winnipeg, the poem that crossed the Atlantic, and I will show you just very briefly the website, just some screenshots, but this is the index page. And the main inspiration for the Winnipeg, the poem that crossed the Atlantic, has been a personal story, but it's also rooted in a historical event of the Spanish Civil War and the Spanish and Chilean historical memory. So interconnected with the involvement of the Chilean poet as well, Pablo Neruda, in the evacuation and rescue of 2,200 Spanish Civil War exiles, including my own grandfather, from French concentration camps, like from Pauliac, I don't know if I pronounced this well, and to Valparaíso, Chile, and in this Winnipeg, the cargo ship in 1939. So this is the website with, you know, the boat of hope. It consists of 7 pages, and then you can access it through the menu, or also there is like a parallax website that you can go down. So here you see the interface of the historical map, and then also you see a list of the passengers on the top from France to Valparaíso, which is a little animation of the 2,200 passengers that were going there. Then this is in 3 different languages, in English and Spanish and French. And then we have the Neruda page here. With again this interface in between is Neruda, is the boat, and is also this, you know, where it could be one of the tropes that we've been talking about, but you know, where Neruda says, the critics may erase all my poetry, but this poem that today I remember, nobody will be able to erase. And this is something that he says when he sees everybody kind of saying bye-bye to their families in the port, and this is like a little interactive piece that, you know, the user is encouraged to interact with it, but it's impossible to erase. Practically, the text comes back again. So then we have the story and the origins of how my grandfather became part of this story, and practically I found my grandfather and his brother or in the internet. I didn't know that he was going in this boat or anything, so this was the origin of the story. It was a surprise that I found in my living room when I was doing another project about visualization of boats coming in and out, and I found them on a boat, so I thought I have to do this work. And then there is the archive, here is in Spanish, and also the Winnipeg archive, where the user can actually find out about different stories from the passengers or any other things that have been submitted. So practically there is a user-generated content, anybody can submit stories, and at the moment there are stories from the Winnipeg, the passengers, from Pablo Neruda, poems, and a whole sort of different things, that then this material becomes part of what it is, the interactive and transatlantic and generative poem, which you have to dive in and explore through that page, and you go to an area, you know, where the text kind of mixes in between narratives and poetic splashes of sea and water and waves, and they're all interlinked, the different kind of there are different words that perhaps interlink to different stories, and also it goes from French to English to Spanish, so there is a whole translation going on here as well. And so my contribution with this work has been looking at transcreation as translation and creative methodology. When I was reflecting on all the other dimensions, I realized that pretty much they were kind of inside this umbrella, you know, to embody the rest of the dimensions. And so the transcreation as a compositional creative process takes part in the concept realization of the work by interviewing the content, methods, and technology, the software, the coding, and in this conceptualization they're also like, you know, like John Cayley was talking about. So there is the visual layers become expressive or linguistic meanings, like in some cases the use of the visual literary tropes and form and semantic aspects come together in the meaning making of digital poetic expression. With John was also like just saying that this, you know, everything comes together. So then that brings me up to the transmedial dimension and the kind of addressing the multimodal relationship between media and semiotic modalities, you know, like text, sound, or visuals. And for instance, we have the website design, the list of the passengers as an animation, the indelible interactive poem, the stories and splashes and waves, visual, concrete, material, and linguistic is all coming together, which, you know, this is also a whole background of, you know, where my research comes from in terms of, you know, Brazilian concrete poets and French and German as well. And so my work is very much based on that aspect, that kind of abstract and transparent, the idea of the abstraction and the visuality and looking at that material aspect of the text, but also the semantic meaning of the different kind of narratives that we are also encountering as we are exploring. And then it's transcreation in the co-creation with the author. So there is the uploaded stories by contributors, and then the kind of remediation of this linear form in the archive to their visual representation in the depth and surface of the transatlantic ocean. So you can, yes, you can see them in that linear way, you can read them in a way that we used to in an archive, but you can also explore them in the sea. And then this kind of also interlaced to the co-creation in transcoding and the collaboration with Alexander Dupier, Berlin, who I was working with to do this programming. He was doing the programming. And then we were discussing the kind of ideas and the stories, the code, the visual representation and aesthetics and poetics and all these kind of dialogues that come out from that. And then we have the translinguistic dimension, which is obviously between languages and is apparent in the translation of the three different websites. And this also engaged me with the process of self-translation, which was also quite interesting when I was talking about the background of the work. And Emile Barbier, we're finishing now. And then Emily Barbier was also taking part in some of the translations that we have been doing. So anyway, I'm not going to go through all that, but part of this transcreation is pretty much looking at design process in different ways, like concepts, ideas, in connection with the work, the process and the production of the work as well. Using different technology, and then the formal origins, and then this kind of remediation and the idea of immediacy and hypermediacy that is coming up from here. And practically the conclusion from here is that as a creator, I have found these dimensions very interesting points to reflect about the process of making and translating, remediating, and I can see how they can serve as well to critically analyze all the multimodal works. And I'm going to be using them as well with my studies, with my students to make them think about the process that they are making. And of course, I mean, this work, it takes you further than just the translation aspect, but then all the idea as well of, you know, the refugees and everything that is going on at the moment. And it's a way to kind of stimulate people to reflect on these, you know, major issues. Okay, so thank you. Manuel.
Well, I am going to wrap it up very quickly. So as you can see, just by the different works that have been presented by the previous speakers, the project is really, I would say we didn't plan it, but the range of projects that we have cover almost all possibilities of digital literature in the present. And so we have one work, which was the work presented by Gabriel, Afternoon, A Story, produced in the late 1980s before the web and within a different platform and using a different code. And that raises the question, how can we translate that work to be published and to be run in the current digital environments? And we also have the work by the team of Soren, the Poetry Machine, which is more of an installation that instantiates the interactional and interfacial and the social aspects of many works of literary literature. And then we have John's The Listeners, which again, it's using the infrastructure, the database of the internet itself, and the infrastructure provided by companies such as Amazon, and doing an intervention using that particular speech synthesizer. And then the work by Maria Mencia, again, it's a multimodal, multimedia work that's presented as a website and engages the readers and asks them to share their own stories and upload their own materials. And finally, this work, The Machines of Disquiet, it's a work by Luiz Lucas Pereira. I'm the translator of the text. The Machines of Disquiet is based... it's a series of works based on The Book of Disquiet by the Portuguese writer Fernando Pessoa. And so far, Luiz has developed 20 machines. And by machines, he means specific formal procedural texts, no? And so some we can all, I think that we can also look at these machines as examples of the type of questions that we have raised throughout the project in terms of thinking about the relation between all those layers that we have mentioned before. And one concept that emerged, which is still rather fuzzy, we need to do more work on this concept, is the concept of electronic or digital trope. So the idea that there's a level in the code of these works that has to be considered as part of their literary form, because that level is the level that is that particular script or that particular instruction or command is the instruction that is generating an experience of the work, and it's generating a certain formal instantiation of the work. No, and one wonders, no, where, for instance, this particular work, I don't have time, maybe in the discussion I could show it, I don't have the time to show it now, but it's an interact, most of these machines have some interactive features, so they are responsive to the textual form, the animation, the textual disposition, all those elements are responsive to the interaction. And so we have to think of those elements, no? So we could go into the JavaScript code and try to think about what would be the element that we needed to define as a unit of translation for any future remediation of this type of work. And so this is another machine. In this case, the letters appear and disappear, so you never have access to the full text. Again, we could do the same thing. In this case, it's a text that two texts that are superposed, and so the act of trying to disentangle the text becomes part of the literary form of the text. So again, we could also think about the coding expression of that particular operation. Another example of a machine, and yet another example. This is a machine that combines sentences from the Book of Disquiet with photographs, black and white photographs, in a more or less randomized way. So again, here we would have to think about this as a script or a particular function that we would like the code to be able to express. So as a general conclusion, we can say that we have tried to reframe translation by placing the translation in general in the context of electronic literature translation. So, and our approach has a theoretical and also a practice-based framework. We also came to the conclusion that when we think of translation, of electronic translation, electronic literature translation as a model for translation, we can talk about the procedurality, the translating procedurality, and the textual instantiations in terms of a range of variations. Now, as we saw earlier in both, well, in the various presentations, the Poetry Machine, the Listeners, and the Winnipeg. Also, we think that the analysis of the code as an element for translation provides an occasion for understanding the rhetoric of interaction, and so understanding how the software frames our and scripts our interactions. And finally, the last conclusion was a redefinition of translation as remediation. So translation must take into account the conditions of performativity that define media as software, and how those material conditions have relocated processes of translation within general processes of remediation. If translation is redefined as a remediation between languages, then e-lit translation can be described as a multidimensional process of remediation that involves natural languages, computer codes, and media materialities. Thank you.